Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Chrysler. And by Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 293 for June 26 of 2015. Lincoln Continental's new design direction. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Barry, we got another show to do today.
We do. How are you, Ben?
I've been doing pretty good. Yeah. Been running all over the place, seeing a lot of things. We can talk about some of it later in the show. The new Chevy Cruze that was just unveiled, Alpha. I didn't go out to that.
You didn't go to Milan?
I did not go to Milano. No. I went to San Francisco instead. Yeah. Ford was doing a whole thing on mobility service.
And I was in Santa Monica, and I was walking down the high-end shopping street and went into a Tesla store. And our friend Anton will be very upset to know that this place is full of people. It was almost like an Apple store with people in there. And I'd never gone into a store before and heard somebody to say the words, boron steel.
A great selling point. And we should let everybody know we've got John Manoogian from the College for Creative Studies here with us today. And it's great to have you back, John. You've been
Thanks.
On a number of times.
Thanks for having
really
me back. It's always a lot of fun.
And, of course, the reason we've got you here is we're going to talk design today. And we should let everybody know our special guest is David Woodhouse, the head of Lincoln Design. And, David, it's awesome having you here on After Hours.
Well, it's good to be here, John. Thanks for the invite.
So where do we start? Gary, you got it? You want to kick this off?
Well, I mean, I think we can't start without talking about the Continental. So for those who didn't have the opportunity to see it or hear or read about the vehicle, tell us what you're trying to accomplish with this concept vehicle that we hopefully will see soon.
Yeah, so the Continental was a show car that we revealed at the New York Auto Show. It was very important for us at Lincoln because it was the reintroduction of the nameplate. And, of course, that carries a lot of historical cachet with it. And also the design of the car was very important because it sets kind of a new design language, a new approach and vision for where we want to go with Lincoln. So most importantly on that was the new face of the brand. So the car introduced the new grille and new front end of the brand.
You can see here.
Oops. Yeah, we're seeing some shots of it come up. David, Lincoln's been working with what some called the bow wave kind of grille. Others, I think, called it like the spread wings. But clearly with the Continental, you've moved away from that. Are we going to start to see the new look spread across the rest of the line?
Yeah, you will, John. This grille will be migrated across all of the range of Lincolns in the future. The bow wave was very good. It was one of the most distinctive faces on the road. And I think the last evolution of that actually is the strongest. But we just felt it was time for a change. I mean, these things have to run a course and then you have to reset and have a future and a way to go. And I think, you know, there's good reason why every luxury premium player has a centralized grille on the face of their cars. And we think this is the right move to make at this point in time with the brand and where our aspirations for where we want to be.
So is this then basically a re-establishment move? I mean, because if we go back through the past several years, I mean, before you came to Lincoln, I mean, there have been several faces of Lincoln, and they keep changing, and it seems that they've changed more often than, say, your crosstown friends over at Cadillac have had a greater consistency. So are we putting a stake in the ground and saying, this is what we're going to look like?
Yeah, we are. We are, Gary. And, you know, I think we have actually been pretty consistent of late. We've now got a showroom that's pretty complete with the face that we've got today. But as I say, I think it was time to reset and mm-hmm. have a new approach to move forward with. But, yeah, we will be consistent with this, yeah, for mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm.
What I like about what's going on right now is Ford announced we're really going to invest in Lincoln. We're really going to change it. And we saw existing models being improved, and improved quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But the Continental clearly signifies a change, all new platform, all new look, and a revival of a real name, not some mix-up of letters and that I can never keep straight whatsoever. You got to be really using the Continental as saying, from here on out, this is the real Ford effort.
Yeah, I think it is. The brand's getting the investment it deserves. And I think you've seen a steady growth in the differentiation from the Ford platforms over the last few years. So I think you can extrapolate that to see that we're searching for more distinction and uniqueness for Lincoln as we go forward. So, yeah, I think it's a great time to be with the brand. I mean, for a designer, I think we get excited at any new product we're working on. But to be with a very special brand, this, you know, iconic American brand, and be at a time of lots of action, product action, that's really awesome.
David, if you know, you mentioned iconic brands. If you were to pick one Lincoln or Continental through its entire history, which one would you pick as kind of the quintessential Lincoln or Continental?
Yeah, I'd pick the 56. I mean, I think a lot of people default to the 61, the Mark II, yeah. Because I think it was the sexiest, you know. It had got the superb proportion. There's even a feeling of kind of like powerboat with that car when you sit in it.
All kinds of,
you know,
hood.
Yeah, the hood rises towards the motif on the front. So even that feeling of that's the highest point of the car and everything slopes down from it, that was an extraordinary design. And I think Gregory and the team back then did an amazing job in how sort of low, lean, and long the proportion of that car was. So I think it was exceptional.
Mm-hmm. I see cues of that Mark II in your Continental. And yet, as you know, we got to talk about it. Bentley, or at least a designer at Bentley, took exception, you know, claiming that you'd completely ripped off the Flying Spur.
Yeah, well, we didn't think that at all. And, you know, the car is distinctly Lincoln, I would say, and we're extremely proud of it. So I really didn't see that, and I think most other people didn't see that either.
I was kind of surprised he was so vocal about that. Usually it happens amongst designers, but never in the public.
Right. You know. Well, you know, they had a car that he did, too, the EXP, and I can't remember. See, I have troubles with all these letters and names, but it was the Speed 6 that they did, which, to my eye, looked like an Aston Martin.
Yes.
So I thought it was, you know, he's calling you out for your design, and one of his designs I think Aston Martin could have gone to him easily enough with.
Yeah, well, we just stay quiet.
Yeah. All right, that's usually the best.
Our design says enough.
So let me ask you a Lincoln design question. So as you're reestablishing not only Lincoln design, but reestablishing Lincoln in the sphere of luxury vehicles, what is the definition of Lincoln vis-a-vis all of the other competitors?
Yeah, I have... a distinct approach on that, because I see all of our competitors heading down this sort of arms race of power, performance, and kind of aggression, right? The front ends of some of our competitors, actually, I'm just amazed that they get away with them, actually have designed them and brought them to market, because they're so scary, right? They seem to be in the business of intimidation to other people on the road. We want our cars to be really about seduction and allure and drawing people in. We don't want to be that overt as our competitors. We want to be about design that is about beauty and elegance and draws people into that beauty. So I think, you know, on the Continental, you're seeing some of that, the surface language, the lines, the gesture of the car. We want something very emotional and very elegant, and I think that's a very different approach to where most of the other competitors are.
It's a much softer execution than Lincoln historically has done also, which was kind of a surprise for me, but nonetheless, it's a much fuller, softer form vocabulary.
Yeah.
So who do you think will find this to be seductive? Who will find this to be appealing? Who will decide that I would prefer to buy that car rather than something from Mercedes or Audi or Cadillac or whomever else?
Yeah, we talk to our customers a lot, Gary, as you probably know. We do a lot of research and a lot of investigation, and we think the time is right. There's a new customer out there, especially in the luxury field, who actually want more discretion in their luxury. And so I think that's very befitting of the brand. I mean, it's like the brand finding its true center again. So I think, you know, if you go back in its history, it always did kind of the opposite to Cadillac, and I think that restraint is absolutely, you know, spot on perfect for this brand and actually where we're heading.
So you don't see this as being, we're going to show this car in the Nürburgring and how...
Exactly. We want to be the opposite to that. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to find other points to touch the hearts and souls of people in a different way.
Mm-hmm. And David, what you're talking about is really what Edsel Ford, who was tasked with Lincoln, wanted with the original Continental. He wanted European continental sophistication, not garish American kind of cars.
Exactly. Intercontinental style, so it can be measured about against the best in the world. That's exactly where we need to be. Yeah.
I love some of the detail that you've got in the car, too. I don't know if this will carry over into production, but you've actually got the Lincoln sort of emblem star thing into the headlamp elements. You've got a sort of a step-and-repeat version of that in the grille as well. Why that level of detail? I mean, specifically bringing the Continental badge into other elements of the car.
Yeah, so, you know, good design is always, I think you've got to have that first, second, third read. And I think, you know, I always look at every design in that respect. Every car I've worked on, we try and see the big picture of the car, the down-the-road impression, the volume, the gesture, the stance. Then as you move into the second read, the surface development, and the third read is really the detail. So every layer has to have the same amount of attention. And, you know, we've used the motif, the repeat of the motif of the badge in lots of different, product placements and parts and components, even down to the show stand. But we really wanted to get that level of just everywhere you look, there's something to discover.
In the interior, it looks like you guys really focused on the passenger versus the driving experience. Was that intentional? I mean, was that part of the story?
Very much so. Again, back to the core of what this car should be about. It's not to say it isn't to be driven, because I think it is. We put a lot of attention around the driver compartment, but we did focus more, I would say, on the second row. And that opened up some new opportunities in design executions and ideas around what we could do in the back, like so that 30-way seat.
In fact, we've got it up on the screen right now.
There we go.
Talking.
And, this sort of ultra-comfort seat, putting that in the back of the car.
And even the seats have a Lincoln design look to them.
Yeah, because they're a shell with the floating cushions, because there's so much adjustability to sort of any body type, they do resonate back to sort of the Eames chair and things like this, right? It's a classic furniture design with a hard shell and the soft cushions. And I think that just sends a message of sort of ultimate comfort, doesn't it?
There's an awful lot of chrome in this. That's the show car,
I was just
going
to bring that up.
Yeah, the chrome was very extravagant on this car, and I think it was as much because we chose this very dark blue position. Mm. Being such a dark color combination, exterior onto interior, you've got to have the relief of material to take away from all that darkness. So, that was the reason in this particular car. We probably wouldn't do as much chrome in production. Mm-hmm.
Did strategically speaking, does China play a role at all in how you guys sort of view this vehicle?
Yeah, again, absolutely. The second row emphasis, we've really learned from the China market that during the week they like to be driven. And at the weekends, they like to drive. So it puts the emphasis on those two positions in the car and doing something very special around both areas.
And one of the things you've talked to me about is design not just being about the object, but design being about an experience, which I found to be very provocative. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I think the customer journey is really the buzz thing at the moment. I think a lot of companies talk in those terms now. I think designers have always intrinsically done that from the first, second, third read. But it's something that's becoming more and more important, I think, in contemporary design, to think about every aspect of the experience that you're embedding in the design, the features and the content, and how you interact with them. So, you know, the abundance of technology and what we're allowed to do today, we have to orchestrate that, curate it in a way that's very intuitive, very simple for people. And I think that's a big point of emphasis going forward, that everything should flow and happen without having to learn it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just taking a user journey and then obviously interpreting that through a brand is really critical, so that every point through that journey, you're getting a special experience, an experience you wouldn't typically expect. I mean, that, I think, is luxury, mm-hmm. something you think wouldn't be possible, but we've actually delivered it for the customer.
Mm-hmm. You're telling a story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You're telling a story. Yeah.
Hey, Ben, do you have a picture of that Continental Mark II that Sean took at Eyes on Design? Do we have that we could bring up? Yeah, here
yeah,
we go.
That car is awesome.
And you know what I especially like is the kick up on the rear panel that comes right after the door, and you've got that on your car as well, David. Is that where that came out of?
Yeah, I mean, we're not the only car that does that, but I think you know it's the gesture of those lines from front to back. You know, typically leaner, longer, lower, wider is better, and especially in this car.
And especially on this car.
But, yeah, I mean, there's so many aspects of this car that are just truly outstanding.
And your grille's different than this one, but to me this is reminiscent of what you've done, or yours is reminiscent of what they did.
Yeah, in a more contemporary way, right. Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, is there a responsibility that you have as a designer of an iconic brand to bring forward design cues from the past?
Yeah, I think we can't get too embedded in the past. I think retro design leads you to there's nowhere to go. So we always have to be pushing forward, right? But I think the great thing with a brand like Lincoln is that the origination of the brand, the reason why it came about, we should feel very proud of. And I think if there's a brand that has an origination that's still pertinent today, that's awesome, isn't it? I mean, it gives you a foundation. Luxury brands typically have a great heritage. So I think it's just something to build off. But you've always got to reinterpret it relevant to the landscape that you're working and living in.
Hmm. Let me ask both of you guys a question, since you're both designers. Could a luxury car company come from nowhere today?
Well, like Lexus did, right?
They did.
Lexus did.
Yeah.
So it's...
We were doing an interesting study about comparing Lexus and Infiniti when they both came out in, I think it was 1989. Mm-hmm. And the approach Lexus used was to literally or figuratively copy Mercedes, whereas Infiniti chose to go kind of its own direction and do a totally unique design language. Look who wound up on top. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that speaks to the American consumer. And there were other issues revolving
marketing
around
and advertising.
Yeah.
Lexus knocked it out of the park.
Right.
They emphasized what great quality
Infiniti was
they
always
had.
The zen.
And, yeah, it was then rocks and trees and ambiguous. You know, Toyota went right to the heart of, look, you know, we build fantastically precise machines. They didn't talk fuel economy
right.
and power. They talked precision. And I think that made a big difference in the launch of both brands. And remember, Acura was only about a year or so before them, too, and it still hasn't hit its stride, if it will.
So speaking of precision and machinery, so when you look at a vehicle and designing it, how much is about that versus how much of it is it about the user interface and the infotainment and all of the non-mechanical bits?
Gary, it's about everything. I mean, we're in, I think, as a designer, you're in the business of actually working with one of the most complicated products you could ever approach. So I think you have to have a foot in everything. You have to see everything. You have to understand everything. And the interpretation, the execution, and the influence of everything is critical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just one more caveat on could luxury brands come from nowhere? Yes, they can, clearly. But I think it always leaves a brand soulless if the heritage isn't there, if there isn't a legacy and a provenance. So I think Lexus and others, I think that's something they still suffer from to a degree,
right.
that in the
right.
customer's eyes, they're quite dry brands, right?
So is there some point in time, I mean, that they can exist and then they have that?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know what that is.
Hyundai's trying really hard right now. I mean,
right. But, you know, Lincoln did a very clever thing a couple of years ago when Ford had signaled, hey, we're really going to try to do something with this brand again. At the L.A. Auto Show, they brought in a bunch of old Lincolns and immaculately prepared very special models at that. It wasn't just any old Lincoln. And the effect was electric. Unfortunately, it was only there for two of the media days, and then boom, boom, it was all gone. The public never got to see this. But it struck me that, to your point, heritage counts for or not. a lot. Mm-hmm. Pedigree counts for a lot. And I'm wondering if there's some things that, from a marketing standpoint, that Lincoln could be doing to remind people, hey, you know, we've been here since the 1920s.
Yeah, and I think you've got to be clever using that heritage, right? You've got to highlight the best and the most important things. Audi does a great job of that. I mean, they to a degree where they actually refabricate, literally, mm-hmm. The cars from the past to bring them to show a relevance to what they do today. So, yeah, if you use it in the right way, cleverly, and it has a relevance to what you're doing today, then it's a great tool, right?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, we're going to have to take a quick break here. We've got to give a good shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. But I want to get, we've got a lot of questions coming in from the audience, but I'd like to know some of the things that you did specifically for Chinese customers. And so think about that in a minute, and we'll be back in less than 30 seconds. Okay, we're back. So, David, as you talked about the Chinese market, and this is going to be critical for the turnaround at Lincoln, you mentioned the back seat, but from an exterior design standpoint, what kind of things did you say, ooh, this is really going to work in China?
Well, you know, I think, like any market, I think the same ingredients apply in China as they do anywhere else. So prestige cars, proportion, gesture, stance, those are really important ingredients that have got to be right on any luxury or premium car. So I don't actually think it's that different in China to anywhere else in the world. The focus on China, though, has given us really good ammunition to get the things and the ingredients that we need. But, you know, as I say, the interior focus on different areas of the interior is one factor. The other really critical thing is the heritage does really mean something there. With Lincoln, you know, the cars are associated with stars and presidents. And so in the dealerships, we've done some really special things. And I think that is a point of attention that we've paid particular focus on.
Okay, as I said, we've got quite a few questions coming in here. Doc Wolf wants to know, what was the reasoning behind the new Continental concept being designed as an homage to your competitors in the luxury space and not designed more in line with Lincoln's current styling? I consider your current styling a very fresh take on luxury. I call it Starship style, and I hope it's not thrown out. Any reaction to that?
Well, I hope the gentleman has seen the car in the flesh, and if he hasn't, I think he should. But I think, you know, that segment is growing, the premium sedan, so it's very important that we generate a car for that area. And, you know, I think it's a great thing. The Continental nameplate has so much goodwill. I mean, we saw that in the feedback and reaction from New York. And I think that's a milestone. It's a great product to get back in the portfolio with Lincoln.
Is that part of a reaction, though, that people like names, as John was indicating earlier when he was trying to remember the name of that Bentley, and it was just an alphabet numeric soup? I mean, that names mean something to people, and you can really...
There's maybe a stronger human connection with the names. And our flagship product, of course, have always had them. So we never got rid of Navigator. So, you know, the future for us will be a mix of probably both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why a four-door sedan and not an SUV?
Well, we're doing a lot of SUV action, as you can see, with like MKC, MKX, Navigator, of course. So I think we've got to have a broad portfolio. I mean, I think to be a true premium player, you've got to have something of everything.
Right? I've got to believe product cycle helped dictate
where
you would say, now let's make a big splash.
Absolutely.
Because the Navigator was just done. The X is, you know, was probably well along the way. And then so on. Let's see. Kevin wants to know, what differentiates American luxury from the rest of the industry, and how does the Continental capture that idea?
I think in the Continental, we were striving for something much more human, so less machine-like, unlike the German players, and more human. I think there's also a certain exuberance with American design that should be there. So the horizontality, the linear emphasis of design, the proportions of those designs, they are different to European, which is perhaps more sporting originated or orientated. So, yeah, human and a little bit of exuberance thrown in.
In fact, I'd like to ask both John and David this question. Patrick Licamont, who just won the Eyes on Design Award, former Renault, in fact, former Ford designer, if you go way back.
Yes.
But he said one of the things he wanted to see again was more nationality
and
in car
gone.
Design.
It's going away.
And why?
Rather than...
Why?
Because it's a global business now. I mean, down at school, we get, you know, 18 students that are graduating, and they're from all over the world. And design has become democratized. I mean, from country to country, it's the same designers moving around, and because you're selling in a global market, it becomes democratized so that everybody expects the same sorts of things.
Yeah, everywhere is so well known, the research that goes on. Everyone's aiming to the same point in the market. So I think that is why. But I, you know, my hope with Lincoln is that actually we will be more distinct and more American.
And design can do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, good design is good design. And, you know, if I look at a Mustang, or you plop a Mustang down anywhere in the world and people go, that's an American car. So, you know, I understand what you gave a great logical reason, John, as to why this is happening. But does Patrick Licamont have any hopes for seeing more nationality in design? David says yes with Lincoln.
Yeah, I think so.
Cars will always look French, too.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
And British cars, maybe.
But, I mean, and for those of you who are listening in, his accent belies the fact that he is not from Dearborn.
Although, you know, I've been in the States a long time. But yeah, yeah, that's right. But I think there is hope. I think, you know, the designers always want to keep the character of, like, the truck, Mustang. The quintessential character of these products is very important. But, yeah, we've just got to work on that long term.
We've got a question here from I'm So Excited, who wants to know, what brand is Lincoln's biggest luxury competitor, and who's the benchmark design-wise?
Well, I really admire Audi because of the attention to detail and the design, the combination of design and engineering that they've had. I think, you know, we look at all of our competitors from BMW, Audi, Lexus, all of them are relevant to us to look at in the contemporary landscape of what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. I would say probably realistically, just from a traditional standpoint, though, sales-wise in the U.S., Cadillac's probably the biggest competitor.
You know, as we look to China, then obviously it is the global luxury.
And Audi's number one in that market.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's also that fact that you said that you're trying to be an alternative to basically what Cadillac is doing, offering the customer something different than they are.
Yes.
Therefore, you're going to have a different segment of the potential customer base.
Michael Ma from San Francisco wants to know, will the new Lincoln Continental be just about luxury, or will it have a sporty side? So maybe we can see that engine from the Mustang GT350 in it.
Yeah, it's too early to say about engine specs. You know, you'll hear about that when the car gets announced. But, I mean, we did announce there was a unique Lincoln engine, a 3-liter.
Mm-hmm. But you don't see a performance, you know, an AMG or a V-series or an M or anything like that, do you?
We have some driver-orientated packs currently, and I wouldn't rule it out long-term, but I don't think there's initial impact. I mean, we put a lot of emphasis into black label and doing very specialized color material and feature ways. But, you know, you can't rule it out long term.
Yeah, talk about black label a little bit. I think that's a very interesting phenomenon that you guys are...
Yeah, black label's pretty special for us because you've got the sort of mainstream color materials, and then we've set up black label as sort of the quintessential, the epitome of what Lincoln can be about. So we offer some really special combinations, and we've put so much attention into curating these very beautiful colorways. So they're not for everyone. They'll be more polarizing. But I think the materials and what we've done on those is super special, yeah.
I love the whole strategy Lincoln's using of being more of a boutique brand and catering to a more discerning audience. Mm-hmm. I think that you're onto something, especially in China with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, the dealerships reflect that really well. I think we've got one of the most special dealership experience in China of any of our competitors.
As a designer, were you involved in designing the looks of those dealerships?
No, I wasn't. The work that was going on there was happening quite a long time before I came back to the brand in the last couple of years. But I know so much effort went in even to replicating the showrooms in a warehouse and working out what customers want to do in the best possible way. So a lot of effort went into developing this.
Got another question here from Autoline After Hours guest 779, who wants to know, does Lincoln need a two-door performance car, i.e. the Mark X, to bring in young customers?
You know, it would be great to see us have a hero car going forward. It doesn't necessarily have to be a performance car. I think something that sets out what we're really, the epitome of what we want to be about would be great. But I think that's back to a different approach, you know, something more fluid, beautiful, elegant. But for sure, a hero car would be awesome for us.
A hero car? So something maybe the length of the Continental, but only a two-door? That would be a hero car. Hero proportions. Let's see here. And we have Wright Knight wanted to know about the model names, but we've already gotten into that. But he's got a comment. In the styling, did you intend to have great outward visibility with the new Lincoln? It looks better than what the competition's doing.
Yeah, visibility is another one of those aspects. You know, designers, it's a constant challenge for us. You know, ergonomics, safety, protection these days. We're really struggling, you know, with human scale in the cars because of everything we have to fit in. And the scale of, like, for example, the section of the A-pillars. We'd love to slim all of that down and have much better visibility out of the cars. We always try and aim for that. But the requirements of safety and crash and pedestrian protection are so great, they drive us to these bigger sections.
Boron steel.
Yeah,
boron steel. Stamped boron steel.
That's the answer.
But isn't that the irony, you know, that these safety requirements are actually making visibility worse, which means that you could hit a pedestrian or crash into something because the pillar blocked your vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hopefully we won't.
Autonomous cars will fix all that.
That's right. Yeah, we'll get into that in another discussion at some point. But David Woodhouse, thanks so much for stopping by and chatting.
Very welcome.
Very, very interesting, and it's going to be a lot of fun to see how this now starts to really evolve.
Damn right. Thanks.
Good deal.
There is no royal blood in this country. Nothing is reserved for anyone. It's all just out there, waiting for someone to reach out and take it. And the ones who do, these are the kings and queens of America.
And, of course, we want to thank Chrysler for supporting this show. We appreciate it greatly when people make this show happen.
Absolutely.
So, very interesting. John, you're a designer. What's your take on how they're trying to bring back the Lincoln brand?
You know, it's really hard to bring back a brand from almost nowhere. Cadillac did it. Audi did it.
I don't think... From a design execution standpoint, I love what Cadillac's doing. The sales aren't there.
No, and quite frankly, a lot of people are scratching their heads about that.
Me too.
These are the best cars they've ever built, ever.
Right.
And they look great. I'm not quite sure.
They drive great, too.
Yeah. I'm driving one. But, yeah, they
okay,
just...
So is it possible that they're being designed and engineered for people who don't exist?
Were to ask... The design team, you know, they try to understand about this whole idea of telling a story, about the experience. As David mentioned, what is it about the brand that is going to resonate with people? And it's not what do they think of the car, it's how does the car make them feel about themselves? And so that whole idea of telling a story with the design, I think, is what's going to help the brand. Now, some do that better than others, but...
Well, to me, what it shows is you can't look at any one thing in isolation.
Right.
The Cadillacs are brilliantly engineered. They're really well designed. The craftsmanship and the overall fit and finish quality is top notch, is equal to anybody, in my opinion. But that's not enough.
I know.
It's image. It's public perception.
It's the brand.
Okay,
right.
So if we go back to when Cadillac started its resurgence, and you think about the art and science crease design that
True.
That they are now softening. But when I think about that, I think of Cadillac in the context of Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll Turn to 11 and being a fighter pilot. Okay, and if you don't
that's
like
kind of.
But I mean, they're
bad.
Moving away from that.
Yes.
I mean, but that's still what I think about when I think about that brand, and I just wonder whether that isn't an issue. And then I was sitting on an airplane yesterday, flying back from LA, and there was a guy who was sitting next to me, and he had his iPad out, and he was scrolling the Audi that he was going to be buying, and he had this whole page, and I mean, he brought up the dealership page, and,
course,
and this
yeah.
is a this was he clearly worked for Disney because I. Saw what else he had on his iPad.
he needed a private screen.
But I mean, it's just like, okay, so I don't know. I mean, I think
a
that
lot
would.
Of it, I think, has to do with the brand. It's like David said. People, the designs are all great for the most part. It's hard to find an ugly luxury car. The quality's there. The technology is pretty much on par with everybody. The performance is there. What's left? It's this idea of how do I identify with the brand, and that's why the Germans kind of have that space
they do.
Nailed.
But it's not just luxury. I look at Mazda's lineup and I scratch my head. Great cars.
There's another,
great to drive.
Right.
Boy, they can't break out of the clutter. Mm-hmm. Versus Subaru, who has decent cars. I don't think they're great. I don't think they're the most handsomely designed cars out there. But they put love in front of their target. They put doggies.
And if you but their value, ass, their value proposition, though, is
the public's eating it up.
Exactly.
But I think that's about the all-wheel drive, the beauty of all-wheel drive, and people look at
sure.
it. And so then you say to yourselves, okay, so if I'm buying a Mazda, what am I buying?
Zoom, zoom.
Right.
But they're buying into the image of the Subaru. They're buying into that lifestyle, that whole thing that is hard to quantify.
Right.
It's this idea that how does it make me feel when I'm driving it mm-hmm. versus it was a logical choice? Because given a logical choice, there's 20 cars that would probably solve that issue. But people that are buying, in that case, the Subaru, there's something about that brand that resonates with those people that say, I feel good when I'm driving mm-hmm. this. People look at me and they think a certain way about me. And so that, I think, is part of that whole story why Mazda can't seem to get it together.
Subaru did a lot of market research, as any company does. And they kept asking people, what do you think about your Subaru? And they kept hearing, I love my Subaru. I love my Subaru. So they finally, it clicked and they went, we got to put love in the tagline. and bang, their sales took off since they, and they didn't talk about their crash rating. They didn't talk about fuel economy. Definitely not about horsepower or anything. They talked about love and put cars in real-world situations that people could, or at least their customer, mm-hmm. could identify with. And I think there's something to be said for that. What's Cadillac talking about? Hey, we're as good as, the M products or the AMGs, and we're in the Nürburgring. It's all hardcore engineering stuff. I think Cadillac's missing the boat. And it would be fascinating to see how Lincoln starts to market this continent.
Well, I think made an interesting point. I think that these guys have a leg up in some ways by basically saying, we're not going to try to outperformance those other
right.
guys. We're not going to try
that's
to.
So
that's
smart.
A losing
and,
game.
And,
right.
and, but what we're going to do is we're going to provide what people perceive as being luxury. And I think a lot of people that are not, the enthusiastic young engineer who's looking at his iPad and selecting his A6 configuration is going to say, I want a luxury car. I want the highest level of quality. I want comfort. I want, everything they're
offering.
But
what made him choose Audi in the first
right.
place?
Right.
Besides all the technical things that he was choosing, which he'd already kind of made his mind up about, he wanted an Audi. Why?
Because
why did he want
when
that?
He tells his friends and family and peers, I bought a new car, and they say, what'd you get? He says, I got an Audi. And they go, ooh. And if he says, I got a Cadillac, they'd say, oh, interesting. Why'd you buy that?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You got to explain it.
It's the brand.
Right.
It's all about the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's so difficult to build. Audi did it, right? In the late 80s, they were
time.
Just about gone.
Right.
Right.
But they managed to sort of build it up slowly but surely over 30 years, and now look where they are.
So this is sort of a loaded question since you are a designer, but does this mean then that design isn't necessarily as important as the marketing function
is? On the contrary, it makes it more important. Because with everything else being equal, the technology, the fuel economy, the safety, the quality, blah, 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 design is the last
differentiator
where I'm wearing this and you're wearing that. It makes me unique. And so how I resonate with that design is what's going to make me, I think, buy it. Mm-hmm. That's the last frontier.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's jump to another brand that just got unveiled this week. We got to talk about the new Alfa Romeo Giulia.
Alfa.
How does Alfa rebuild itself? As a designer speaking, John, how would you do
it? You know, in all fairness to them, because I haven't seen the actual car, looking at the photographs, looks nice.
To me, it's predictable. I'm surprised.
It doesn't
they
break
didn't
any
put,
new ground.
It doesn't.
It's nice.
It's very
well executed.
Right.
All right, so let me ask you, so as a designer, this is from Alfa. Three peculiarities of Italian design: sense of proportions, simplicity, and care for surface quality. Couldn't any auto manufacturer in the world say that?
You could have used that sentence for almost any car company.
David Woodhouse could have said that.
Right.
He could have. Because those are the things that really drive the design. It's proportion, it's surface execution, it's all, you know, the passion. It's all those things that you just mentioned.
So any designer working for any car company anywhere in the world is probably worried about those three things.
Among a multitude of other
right.
things, yes. Absolutely, of course.
So there's nothing distinctive about that, which gets sort of back to your point of, like, no ground has really been broken here.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to distinguish yourself. And here we got a picture.
It's 500 horsepower.
510.
Yeah, well, that's the high-performance version, right?
Well, we haven't seen the base car.
They didn't announce any other things.
Foglio is what we're looking at here, you know, the top end of it all. And, you know, I look at that, and,
it's nice.
From the side view, it's nice, but I expected something more.
But I would also argue that given that execution, the brand is what will drive mm-hmm. whether that car is successful or not. And whether that Alfa brand has been totally forgotten in this country now, or whether there's still a kind of a hardcore group of people that look at Alfa and they go, wow, they're back. I can finally get an Alfa after 20, 30 years, however long they've been gone. To me, the brand is what will do it. Because I wouldn't buy it because of its looks. I mean, it's nice.
It's nice, but
it's
right.
nice.
So... why would somebody buy something like that conceivably? I mean, I know this is all theoretical, versus a Lexus IS.
The brand. Because in their own mind, they would say, boy, Alfa's got this rich, storied history of racing. They've got a huge historical background of racing. That appeals to a lot of people. This high performance, they're kind of related to Ferrari, Maserati. I mean, it's all those.
And the name.
That Italian.
Alfa Romeo.
Okay. All right, so I discovered what Alfa stands for.
Oh, yeah, it's an acronym, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It stands for, in English, the Lombard Automobile Factory Public Company.
Well.
How sexy is that?
What is it? Automobili Lombardo something or other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they've been around forever.
June 24th, 1910.
That's forever.
That's forever. Yeah,
that's
way
a long history.
Back. Right.
And their racing history is.
So let's say this was the Dearborn Automobile Factory. I mean, who the hell's going to buy that?
Well, if the cars were beautiful and had a pedigree,
right.
I think you might be surprised.
That's right.
Okay, we're going to take another quick commercial break and give a shout out to our friends at Hyundai.
We should probably.
We could tell you about the years of research and development, how we forged advanced high-strength steel to make the frame stronger yet lighter, the countless hours spent testing the suspension and tuning every sound from the engine to the trunk. But until you get behind the wheel, you have no idea. The completely redesigned Hyundai Sonata.
We're back. We're talking design, and another big car, or another important car, got unveiled last night. by Chevrolet, the new Chevy Cruze.
Chevy Cruze. Yeah.
Have you had a chance to see it, John?
Only the photographs. It looks very good in the photographs.
It looks really good.
To me, it looks very good. They did a really great job on that car.
So this is your old friend John Cafaro said.
It is.
With styling influenced by the acclaimed 2014 Impala and all-new Malibu, the 2016 Cruze brings Chevrolet's new expressive global design language to the small car segment. What do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with him.
So is Impala and the new Malibu worthy places to draw inspiration from?
I think from a design statement, probably the Impala and the upcoming Malibu are where Chevrolet is headed, design-wise, form vocabulary-wise. I think that's kind of setting the tone now for the rest of the cars that will follow. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good thing. I mean,
I agree, too. Here we've got a picture of it up here.
I need to see one up close, but...
I know. Actually, it reminds me a lot of the new upcoming Volt. Even mm-hmm. though the grill treatment is different, but I see a lot in the silhouette of the car.
Right. When they unveiled the Volt, they also went back to the Impala and said that they wanted to get mm-hmm. some design cues from there. And then, mm-hmm. of course, the Malibu being between the Cruze and the Volt introductions.
I mean, if we were to park that car next to the Alfa, I think this is just as good.
That looks just as good.
I think so. And the Alfa's fine. This one looks as good, if not better.
The only problem I have with this, and we mentioned, you know, the upcoming Malibu and Impala, is that passenger car sales are shrinking as everybody's running to crossovers.
That's why I asked about the SUV.
Yeah. Yep.
So do you see that as being a challenge going forward to the industry as a whole?
I mean, you know, sedans to me are losing favor for whatever reason, and it's always baffled me because, you know, there was always the idea that people wanted to sit higher, they wanted to be able to see better, they felt safer in an SUV versus a car. I think a lot of people should have sort of gotten over that now, but they haven't.
No.
They haven't gotten over it.
And it's a global thing. And when I try to reduce it to its most basic, we're moving away from three-box design
yes.
to a two-box
yes.
design. And the D-pillar has got to have that right angle so it doesn't look like a minivan, but
right.
does not look like a car hatchback, even though these things are hatchbacks. And the H-point's got to be at about 38, 39 inches. And if you get some combination of all that, voila,
yeah.
the public shows up and starts mm-hmm. buying it.
Right.
Although to Cruze's favor here, that according to Chevrolet now, it's Chevy's best-selling car around the world, 3.5 million sold since it went on sale in 2008.
Oh, okay,
but this I think is interesting. Cruze sales in the U.S. in 2014 were 273,060. A 10% increase over its numbers in 2013.
Hmm.
And 53% of U.S. Cruze customers are new to Chevrolet.
How much? 53%?
53, new to Chevy.
That's a big number.
Well, look, the 273, or what did you say that was? 270 what thousand?
273,000.
That's a lot of cars.
Right.
These days, that's a lot of cars.
10% over 2013. So it's growing its segment. And then in the U.S., Cruze is the segment's second best seller to customers under 25. So they're getting a youthful,
that's a good number.
New
yes.
person in there. So, I mean, I think this car probably is going to... No, but then the question becomes, okay, so then why do you have a Malibu?
Yeah. Malibu's bigger.
Right.
But
I mean...
Is it big enough to be that better, much better than the Cruze? I can't...
Well, you know, I might even ask, why do you have a Sonic?
Yeah.
You know, so they've got Spark, Sonic, Cruze, Malibu, Impala, five pass cars.
Volt.
And Volt, but Volt is kind of a specialty thing. But,
yeah,
but to your point,
I mean,
it's still,
you know,
a fast car.
Somebody goes in there,
that's
showroom,
slicing the market pretty thin. Maybe that's what you got to do these days. I don't know, but I think Chevrolet needs a lot more crossovers.
Yes, and Cadillac really needs.
They're dying for it.
Crossovers.
Do you think that would be the? So let's say that you know, getting back to Cadillac here, crossover. But what does that do to the performance sedan direction that they seem to be taking?
BMW has proved that you can still have that performance side of their business, and they can bring out all these other entries, probably too many, but they can cover that part of the market as well. And Audi's going down the same road, so is Mercedes.
I think they're coming out with too many models. I think this is going to come back to bite them.
I agree.
You know, when you look at, what is it, the X5 and the X6, and the only difference is a little bit of the backlight angle.
Mm-hmm. Why'd you bother?
Jeez. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, if they can make it work, more power
well,
to
yeah.
them. And this gets back to being, importantly, a global brand. So, yeah, the U.S. market may not support being able to tool that up, but on a global basis, they can do it.
Sure.
So there's another interesting thing that happened this week with Mini saying that they're going to be dropping the coupe Roadster in Paceman. What do you think about what's going on there?
Just this comes right out of what we were talking about. Too many models.
Yeah.
You know, even Honda ran into that. Anytime it's trying to do anything that's a little bit away from its core, it fails miserably. And we're talking about Honda. But if you look at, you know, the Cross Tour, the Element, the CRZ, the Insight, I can't even name them all off on the top of my head, but, you know, when they deviate away from Civic, Accord, Pilot, CRV, you know, things start to come off the wheels for them. And I think that's what Mini's run into. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the latest one that they showed yesterday just seems like 11/10 scale. It's gotten so big.
Well, that was one of the things they were boasting that the...
Well, what do you think, Gary? Why do you think they dropped it?
Well, I think it gets back to this proliferation that you're talking about. I think that they just wanted to be, you know, all things to all people, have too many models due to so many variants off the thing. And I mean, I've looked at the numbers, and I mean, it's horrible. Last year they sold 956 coupes in the United States.
1,000 Accord coupes?
No. The Mini Coupe.
Oh, Mini Coupe.
With
coupe.
A little
in the in the, yeah, yeah. The Roadster, they sold 1,437. So like, how can you have numbers like that?
I mean, you can't.
It's not a special niche vehicle, and they were concerned with.
I know how the conversation went. They went to the board and they said, "Hey, we need another $800 million," and they said, "Oh yeah, how much money you make on the last $800 million? Oh, we didn't make anything.
Oh, you mean that $800 million?
Right.
Okay, right. Gary, what else should we
All right, so here, see, this is so Ford, I mean, so they had a big event this week, and they talked about the future and what's going to be going on in terms of the auto industry and mobility and things like that. And as you know, as I jokingly pointed out to you this morning, that, you know, we've got a new Alpha, we've got a new we had Al Oppenheiser in here a couple of 3 weeks ago, the chief engineer on Camaro, and they introduced the
convertible
which was sort of, I mean, isn't that a little early in the cycle to be introducing the convertible?
The regular car's not even out yet.
Right. Oh. Isn't it usually that you have the regular out for a year or two and then say, okay, I'm going to have
sure
the convertible?
They know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Famous last words. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. And then Ford introduced a new electric bicycle. But literally, they,
you know, yeah.
they introduced
no, it. Have
bicycle.
You seen the bike?
That's all about this car sharing mm-hmm. idea.
Mobility right. services.
And that's becoming such a big deal. In fact, the Mini supposedly is going to embrace
as
part of their business plan.
Right. And so the rationalization of this electric bicycle is that basically you can have it in your Ford vehicle, you can take it apart like so.
Right.
And then you can also, it'll fit in all Ford vehicles, they say, and you can recharge it while it's in there. And
the guy who's done that, and I think that's Bruce Williams, I think is the designer's name, this guy's off the F-150 program, mm-hmm. and he's designed a bicycle. And that's my question to you, John. What do you think about, I mean, Ford just didn't run out and partner with somebody. They designed their own bike. Now, I don't know.
This is our third bike.
Correct. They have sort of like a commercial delivery package thing and another even smaller one to fold up.
This gets at that whole idea of car sharing, mm-hmm. where you park your car somewhere, he takes the bike, and then someone
right.
comes and takes your car and uses it and then brings right. it back, and ultimately you get paid for that.
Right.
That's a concept I still haven't.
Yeah, well, they
fully embraced.
In fact, they announced that they, and this really surprised me, Ford Credit has piloted this program where they're vetting people who would be interested in letting this happen. That, you know, I want your car when you're not using it.
Who's going to make sure it comes back clean and the way
I want? But they're also vetting the people who are going to be able to do this. But,
yes.
All right. So we don't have the clever graphic for this, but I still want to quiz you guys on this.
Okay.
So talking about the millennials and car sharing and stuff like this, and you cheated because you read these.
No, I didn't actually.
All right. So this is Ford. Sourced this study from Penn Schoen Berlin, which is a a company that does research. And so percentage of millennials who will rent out their belongings to supplement their income. Now, this is any belongings.
I'll bet it's high. And maybe I saw this. I'm going to say 40%.
Wow. I have no idea.
33.
33.
Mm-hmm.
So one out of three.
One out of three.
Are willing to
anything.
Just their belongings.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So so how do the millennials rank car sharing in relation to book lending? So I lend you a book. You can read my book and you know, which is, okay. Car sharing, book lending.
Well, I loan a book. I don't expect somebody to pay me. Are you talking about paying me for me loaning you your car?
No, it's just basically saying, you take my car.
I'd say much lower. I'll say 10%.
Second, book lending, cars.
Wow. Really?
Okay. All right. Percentage of millennials open to sharing rides with others. Of course,
that's probably a much higher number.
We all grew up hitchhiking. I don't see how that's...
I'll bet that's very high. I'll say 70%.
60%.
Less than 50.
Less than 50.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm.
All right. So what do millennials and Gen Zers see as advantages of sharing goods? And nobody's going to be able to guess this one. 50% said that the advantage of sharing goods is saving money. So this gets back to, I buy my car... And it's sitting in the park, sitting in a parking lot all day long. And John, I will let you share my car, but
you
have to pay me money so I can put that toward my car. 40% say they think sharing goods is good because it allows them to try new products.
Yeah.
And 33% say it provides them access to more options. So you have a pickup truck, and I've got this mulch I need to move.
Yeah.
And I've got this mini that'll no longer be made available. No. So we do it that way. But, I mean, what does this do in terms of, again, from a designer point of view, designing cars thinking that these people want to share these things and not...
You'd be surprised how many projects we've had down at College for Creative Studies that get at this idea of car sharing... what the future holds once cities ban car usage within the city limits. And being millennials and Gen Xers, I was always kind of surprised at how the students reacted to the idea of that, because I wanted no part of it.
Abhorrent.
And they embrace it. I mean, they don't think anything. But, the question I would always ask is, well, who's going to make sure that it comes back clean and it's the way I left it without damage? And that doesn't even enter their thought process. They just assume, well, I have this car, I'm going to loan it to you, and you're going to bring it back to me. It's going to be as you got it, and I'm going to have money in my hand. And I can't get my brain around that. But they're accepting it. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the future, particularly in large cities, because when you have companies like Toyota and Ford that gave us the projects, thinking about it back at their respective places, you know that they're giving it some really serious thought. So that's the way of the future.
Do you see this changing the nature of the car industry as we know it today?
It'll change the business model, I believe. But I think everyone's concerned that it's going to change the sales numbers. I think that's where everybody's sweating is, what's this going to do to our volumes? If we're selling 100,000 cars today and everybody decides to go buy one and they're going to share it with everybody else, maybe we're only going to sell 50,000. Then what are we going to do?
Do you think it's going to happen, John?
I do. I think it's going to be massively disruptive. I think it's going to turn this business upside down.
Yes.
I think it's going to impact within the decade.
All
within
the above.
The decade?
By 2025.
All the above.
Really?
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, no, I think
agree.
It's going to be massively disruptive, and I commend Ford for going out and experimenting. I think Ford recognizes this better than anybody.
And they were the ones that gave us that project.
And I credit Bill Ford Jr. with pushing the company to get into this.
Yes.
I see big trouble ahead. Sergio's talking about, I can't get the volume now. This is what's going to force the mergers.
Right.
There's a report from Barclays that came out looking at this. Now, they're saying over the next three decades, But they're saying General Motors will have to close 68% of all their manufacturing facilities, and Ford will have to close 58%. So now, even if they're wrong by half, even if they're only 10% right, you're talking about closing quite a few plants and getting rid of a lot of people.
That's scary.
But it all comes back to car sharing, cities banning automobiles.
Yes. I mean, if you live out in Iowa, obviously you need to have a car. But when you live in New York City or Chicago or San Francisco or Los Angeles,
to own one.
You can own one. It's so prohibitively expensive to own a car. Where are you going to park it? How are you going to insure it? And the millennials don't want any part of that. They don't want to be bothered by that.
So do you think it's possible, I mean, to get back to David Woodhouse being here earlier, that there's basically be this bifurcation in the market whereby there will be luxury products, there'll be large, big luxury vehicles, and then there'll basically be utility sorts of automobiles that everybody else has?
I think everybody has to get around. How they do it, there's going to be a multitude of solutions, whether it's a personal pod that I get from here to there, whether it's something that I borrow from him, or whether it's a company that produces a two-seater, four-seater, whatever it is, or a luxury car. People still have to get around. Now, mass transportation is going to enter into that mix probably a lot more than it has historically. But we still need to move from here to there every day, somehow, some way.
So where does the autonomous car play into all this?
It can help accelerate what we're talking about. Because now the autonomous car comes, picks me up at my house, drops me off at the office, knows to go pick up somebody else, and now we don't need humans handling the logistics of it. The car will just go to where it's next needed. And maybe to your point, John, it stops at, and I think car dealerships are going to play a big role in this, it runs by the dealership, gets a cleaning, both inside and out, they check everything, make sure it's right, it's off to the next customer.
And to get back to David, in the luxury market, which brand has really embraced this whole idea of autonomy? Mercedes. They've staked out that luxury autonomous car. I mean, they own it now, and no one even makes cars like that yet. But they've already established in everyone's mind that they are the leading proponent of luxury cars that are going to be autonomous, with all the show cars that they've done.
Right.
No one else has done that. BMW, Audi, Lincoln, Cadillac. Mercedes has sort of planted their flag and said, we own that autonomous luxury market.
So it's Mercedes for the 1%, Google for the 99%?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that where it's coming down to?
Yeah.
Probably, yeah.
Hey, one more topic that we should get into before we wrap the show up. John, at CCS, you guys got a fascinating invitation from Ferrari. So you tell the story.
What an opportunity. Every 3 or 4 years, Ferrari has had a Ferrari design competition. And the last one we had was 2011. They invited 50 schools from around the world to compete. They narrowed them down to 8. College for Creative Studies was one of the last 8. This time, they invited only 4 schools around the globe. Honeek University in Korea, Pforzheim from Germany, IDS from France, and CCS was the only school in the United States to be invited to
the competition. Which is really saying something.
That's really saying something. So those 4 schools have been involved since probably January. We just sent our 3 design proposals to Italy. They're currently there. The models got there okay, so the judging will take place probably within the next month or two. We'll see what happens.
So what was the brief? I mean, what were you...
The brief was 2040 to design a car which would be Ferrari's kind of mainstream vehicle. So we had 5 teams of 2, and they each approached it kind of in a different way. And I was surprised, again, at what the students view as a future Ferrari versus what my mental model was. And they came up with some really creative solutions. But Ferrari chose 3 of our 5. So those are the 3 that went forward to build hard models, and then they were shipped to Italy. So we'll find out how we did here very, very shortly. But that was such an opportunity. Ferrari does. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing it'll be probably Sergio and then Flavio Manzoni and all of the Ferrari design team and engineers. And
Yeah.
So if you were to take those three and synthesize, what's the sort of flavor of what the gun designers think?
Extreme. Extreme to the point of almost being a caricature of a car. And I was a little surprised at that because, you know, we talked a lot about beauty. Ferraris have always been about performance and beauty. And if you don't have those two elements, it's not a Ferrari. You know, you can have a great performing car, but if it's not beautiful, it's not going to be a Ferrari. Conversely, you might have a beautiful car, but if it doesn't perform well, it's not going to be a Ferrari. So you have to have those two elements along with the sound and the smell and a bunch of other things. But how the students approached it, because most of them had never even sat in a Ferrari, it was interesting the way their thought process went to what a Ferrari buyer or owner would be expecting 30 years from now, 20 years from now. Hybrids were like the main focus. Electric, whatever. But the sound is what's important also, and that's a big deal for a Ferrari.
But so did you get involved in sound design? I mean,
well, no. I mean, but see, it's that whole experience of the car. When you get into it, there's a sense of occasion. You know something's going to happen. You know, it's this noise, it's the smell, it's all the senses are involved. Mm-hmm. The touch, it's all there. So the design sort of evolved around what is it that the customer's looking for in their Ferrari that's really going to make it special. It has to be a very special experience. And so they came up with these really wild, very creative ideas. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Well, I hope one of your guys wins, or one of your teams win. But I think just being one of four selected in the world is accomplishment enough.
To have that in your portfolio, I told them, because they did this on their own. This was not a class. The way the timing worked out for our school, we were a little late to the party, so we had to do it as kind of after-hours thing, literally. So the guys, and they were all guys, did this all on their own time.
And it's not like they're not busy, right?
Well, and a couple of my students in my class kind of blew off my class to do the Ferrari thing, but I said it's okay. It was all right.
Okay. It's their loss.
Well, a great portfolio piece. So we'll see. I'll report back in a couple of months.
Cool. We'll have you back then, sure. Bud. Thanks great. So much for stopping by.
Thank
this
you.
Was great. Great having another designer with, you know,
thanks.
David Woodhouse here.
It's always fun.
And Gary? Not
next week.
Week not
after.
Next week, because we're shutting down the office next week. It's the
4th of July.
4th of July week. But we'll be back with more.
We will.
Want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Chrysler. And by Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.